Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Elevate your bedroom with our fresh new bedding designs and colours. In store and online at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. 51551 is our text number. By the way, just to answer that question, which was burning through phone lines this morning, when St. Patrick's Festival announced that the mascot this year, well, we know the Grand Marshal is Patrick Keelty, St. Patrick, and they said the mascot this year will be Mr. Tato. And a number of people said, what about Barney and Beanie? Beanie, the Bisto Kids, Tony the Tiger, Pat the Baker, old Mr. Brennan, the Jolly Green Giant, Jim Figgerty. Does anyone remember Jim Figgerty and Bertie Bassett? But apparently the St. Patrick's Day Festival are being paid by Tato. They're partnering with Tato for the national. So we presume, let's hope they're getting a handsome fee, because it's an Irish company that was set up, I think, 70 years ago by Spud Murphy in Moore Street in Dublin. I even remember that when the little salt used to be separate in the packet. And it's now owned by a German multinational, which is fair enough. And we presume they're paying handsomely to get that gig on St. Patrick's Day, where Mr. Tato apparently will be not just a mascot, but all along the route. Let's hope he's given out a few packets of Tato. And remember, there's no smoky bacon without fire. Joe at RTE.ie, 51, and no salt and vinegar gags, please. Joe at RTE.ie, 5155. There's a great story told about Spud Murphy, the original founder of Tato and the inventor of Tato and cheese and onion flavour. But not a lot of people know this. But Spud Murphy, when he started working in Moor Lane behind Moor Street in the late 1950s or 60s, and he invented cheese and onion, and the little salt in the packet was in a little separate sachet, he was brought to court by a disgruntled customer who said she found the tail of a mouse, or a mouse's tail, indeed, in a packet. And it was in court, and the exhibit was duly produced and laid in front of the judge. And the poor woman said she got such a shock, she fell into such a weakness when she saw the thing, that she said to herself, if I had eaten that the tail of that mouse, or the mice's tail, or the mouse's tail, I would have died. I would have died with the shock. So Spud Murphy stepped up and he walked across. He picked up the mouse's tail and swallowed it. And that was the end of that case, because Spud Murphy lived, I think he emigrated to Canada, and he invented one of the greatest Irish products, was one of the iconic, emblematic Irish products of all time, Tato. And still with the original taste, and as I say, so many different varieties. Now, let's go back to the serious issue that began yesterday's programme, OCD, Obsessive Compulsive Disorder. We'll have Mela in a sec, but first of all, we have Jimmy Blake. Jimmy, good afternoon.
How are you, Joe? How are you getting on?
Well, good. How are you getting on? When did your OCD begin, so far as you can remember, Jimmy?
It started with me now in 1985. So I'm living with it a long, long time. And it started off very, very slowly, but built up into a massive problem for me. I got the familiar contamination type of OCD, and slowly but surely everything became dirty for me.
Okay.
I couldn't touch door handles, light switches, money. Wow. Money was a big thing.
Oh,
coins.
Yeah, money, notes and coins, yeah.
Coins especially, you know.
Yeah.
I used to, if I had coins, before I'd go out, I'd fill up a sink with water on Dettol. And I'd clean all the coins. But the problem was, if you went into the shop and you bought something,
you got
change.
Yes.
So that was unclean change. So you'd be going home. If you went into the house, I used to have this little box that I would strip completely naked, and put all my clothes into the box and walk straight into the shower or the bath. I could be hours in there. Then when I got out, I would have to come out and with a Dettol cloth clean the box. now, so then other people could brush up against that and I wouldn't be contaminating anyone else, like, you know, so...
And have you any idea, Jimmy, when or why it started?
I think I was always a kind of anxious kind of a child. But I think I met a very, very good psychiatrist when I was going through this, and he came out with a phrase, like, he says, like, if you go into an A&E and you broke your leg, the doctor might ask you how you broke your leg, but he doesn't really care. You know, the treatment is still the same. And this psychiatrist says to me, I'm going to treat you for your symptoms. Now, he says, if you want to go back later on in life to find out what caused your OCD, you walk away. But at the moment, I'm just going to cure your OCD. So that's what he proceeded to do. And did it very well.
And given, great, and we'll talk about that in a second as to how. But Jimmy, given you mentioned there about money, you mentioned there about showering, about your clothes in a box. So were you wary of leaving your house?
Oh yes, I became completely agoraphobic. I could not leave the house. I found it so hard to eat that it was just easier not to. Even if I prepared the food myself, I had no guarantee the plate was clean. I had no guarantee the fork was clean. It was easier just not to eat. Like, I'm 5'8", and I went down to below 10 stone. I used to get sometimes if I were really, really hungry, I'd get a bag of crisps, and I'd open them up, and I could dip my tongue onto a crisp and flick it into my mouth. And that's the way I could eat a bag of crisps.
What, you could not touch the crisp? Potato,
oh no!
Which are I don't mean to. Anyway, it's a very serious issue. Sorry, but you could not lift a crisp with your hand.
No.
Why? Why, Jimmy?
Well, there was no guarantee my hands were clean. I would have washed them 50 times, 60 times a day. Like, it got that I washed all the oils out of my hands, and all my hands would split and bleed, and I would take a 4-hour bath. Now, I'm quite aware that there is other people here with OCD maybe listening, and I don't want to be giving them ideas, but this is the things I used to do. I'd lie in the bath, and I would put a lot of Dettol in the bath. And to clean every orifice, I would take up handfuls of the water with Dettol in it and suck it up through my nose and spit it out through my mouth.
Jimmy.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
And I would still feel unclean. I was very aware of Bernadette yesterday when she says some people can joke about it. I wish I'd get you over to my house and clean it. It gets me so angry. You know, this is not a laughing matter. I wouldn't wish this on my worst enemy. I'm amazed I even survived this long in my life, that I've tried to commit suicide that many times. I slashed my body umpteen times. I've hundreds upon hundreds of stitches over the years of just sliced myself open so that I could feel physical pain and just take away from the mental pain of this. It's very, very, very hard.
I'll come back to Jimmy T, but how did you deal with it? Because you sound well now, am I right?
I am.
That's
why I don't mind talking about it.
Brilliant.
I never talk
about it. So this is incredible. And when you were talking there about the Dettol and the drinking, like, obsession. And I know it's called obsessive compulsive disorder, but obsession really jumps. How did you come to cope with it and deal with it?
It's a combination of over the years, medication and CBT, cognitive behavioural therapy, and determination. You have to dedicate your life. This is the most important thing in your life. Nothing is more important. You dedicate yourself to getting better.
Okay.
And if you do that, you will get better.
And CBT deals with we are where we are, the here and now. And as the therapist said to you, well, if you want to find out the reason why you're like this, you can do that later on. What I want to do is deal with the symptoms.
And slowly but surely, you get, you know, you're told to touch that door handle, touch that light switch. But slowly, and then learn how to relax and learn how to not associate fear and anxiety with this.
Because it just strikes me from your description, you are extraordinarily hard on yourself.
It's very, very hard. It's very hard. And you have no life. You have no life. But I'm here now to say that it does get better. And I'm back working. I'm a painter and decorator.
Right.
Now, I have to get in and around toilet bowls and everything now to maybe cut in skirtings, everything. If I go now to cross the road and I press the button for the green man, I'll press the button and I'll lick my finger. Yeah. And it's to prove that I can do this. I went to a conference one time and a man, he said, before I talk, I want to show you this. And he took his shoe off and he licked the sole of his shoe. And there was hundreds of people in the auditorium at the time. And the screams of people was deafening. But I always thought if I could do that, I would be well. And I just wanted my life back. And now I've done it on numerous occasions. So it does work. The CBT and the medication does work. And you can have your life back. It just takes time and determination.
Okay, stay with us, Jimmy. Mela, good afternoon.
How are you?
How are you?
I'm good. He's done amazingly well, my God. It's,
And you describe you intrusive thoughts.
Yeah, I get intrusive thoughts. It's called pure OCD.
Okay.
So where it's just in the head. Do you know what I mean? So you think if I was cooking or something sometimes, and then I'd you know, have the knife in my hand, and then I think, did I hit them? Did I hurt anybody? Do you know what I mean? And it was like, you know, you didn't hurt somebody. Because the evidence is in front of you, but you just keep looking and checking to see if it is or everybody's okay. Do you know what I mean? So it's kind of this, you get in a spiral. It's like getting into a whirlwind. Do you know what I mean? And all these, they just keep bringing you up and down and up and down. You know what I mean? Like you get stuck as well and you just can't move and you just feel the anxiety because you don't ever want to hurt anybody. That's the thing. It's usually people with OCD don't want to hurt people.
Of course, yeah.
You know, because the fear of...
Yeah.
I guess I like checking for his contamination. My son has got the same OCD as the other person,
Jimmy. Yeah,
and
Jimmy.
Very, very similar. You know, to Jimmy. So, and it's just, but it's just. It's
and
like,
when you have a knife in your hand in a kitchen where there's no one else, and you're worried about did I injure somebody? What's it like when you get into a car?
No, people would be in the room would think in a car. I've got into a car and I would drive backwards and forwards. If I'd gone over a bump in the road, I would think that I've hurt, and I'd go back to check, you know, and even though I know it's not real. Like I'm standing there, part of me is standing out of my body going, this is not real, Mela, but you're in it.
Yeah.
Because the anxiety has come right up in front of you and it's sitting there on your chest. It's in your breath. It's in your thoughts. It's in everything. Do you know what I mean? That's the way it is, and it takes over. Do you know what I mean? So the logical brain takes a back seat for a while, and then you have to bring that logical brain back in to these thoughts and go, well, they're not real, Mela. You know what I mean? You've driven up the road now four times. You haven't hit anybody. Do you know what I mean? So it's that kind of thing, you know. So it's.
But you would. But you would if you hit a pothole or a bump and you drive on. You say, oh, "Hang on, was that a child?"
Yeah, yeah. You go back and check.
You go back, and would you go back twice?
No, a bit more than that sometimes. You know, it depends on where the anxiety is and how high it is, how much a hit's gone in and hit you. But the thing is about it, there is help you can get. The main thing is that you're not, like as your last person really fought for himself, and you have to fight for yourself. You have to have that turn around in your head and decide, no, I want to be here and I want to live normally. And I live normally now for a very long time, which is good.
Yeah,
great.
Mada, you had a variation on OCD. What do you call it? Pure O
O C D. Pure O O C D. Yeah. There's different types of OCD.
Give me the full acronym and what it stands for.
Pure OCD. It's pure intrusive thoughts, basically.
Oh, okay, intrusive.
Intrusive thoughts. So I would have the thoughts. I wouldn't have. You know, I wouldn't have the actions. I'd have the actions of going and checking to make sure I didn't harm anybody.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? I'd be talking to a friend of mine, and suddenly a thought would come to my head and go, "Did I do? No, you didn't, Mel. No, you didn't." And they go, "Mel, are you okay?" And I'm going, "Yeah, I'm okay. I'll just go and get something." You know what I mean? Just to kind of break it and kind of, you know what I mean? So it was intrusive thoughts coming into your head. You know what I mean?
Would you get intrusive thought? No,
but you feel responsible for the thought, even. Do you know what I mean?
So would you get intrusive thoughts when other people are in front of you?
Yes, you can have intrusive thoughts when people are in front of you. Yeah.
Can I come back in there, Joe, just for 1 second?
Yes, Liam, of course. I'll come back to you in a second, Mal. I promise about the intrusive thoughts. Go ahead, Liam.
I just want to say that I got the after a few years of battling the contamination, when I got the pure O as well, and exactly the same. If I was driving down the road and I hit a bump, I'd say, "Now, was that a person or was it not?"
Yeah.
And you could go back 10 times, and then you could go home and you could go to bed that night and think, "Yeah, no, I checked." No, I have to check again. Yeah. And you get up out of bed and you go back.
Okay.
And with a flashlamp, look around and maybe the body's in the ditch. And you go into the ditch and check through into it. Uh-huh. You know, it's ridiculous. And you know you're being irrational.
Yeah.
But it still has the anxiety there on you to check. Because you don't want to hurt anyone.
And Mela, do you have intrusive... Come back to... Just in terms of the pictures... And trying to deal with it. Intrusive thoughts when other people are there. Do you tell them about your intrusive thoughts?
No, I know. I actually very good friends of mine that were very helpful to me, and I explained what was going on for me, that, you know, I got these thoughts, and, you know, just to... Because sometimes I'd have to check their car, you know what I mean, or something. And they were very kind to me. Mm-hmm. I was very fortunate to have people around me that were really kind and understood that they knew me as me, but they also this other side of me, which was very, very different and contradictory to the other side. But, you know, we all have different sides to ourselves anyway, do you know what I mean? So, but it's just, and so they were just lovely. They let me check to make sure it was okay, do you know what I mean? And, you know, and I would never tell them the thought, because I didn't want to tell them the thought, because if I said the thought out, it probably would have been better for me, you know. But later on, when I kind of... But later on, I was able to say to them, "This is what I'm feeling." So I'm, you know, it's, and they knew me well enough, do you know what I mean? So I could share, you know what I mean?
Okay.
But also, I went through a very good therapist who was very well known, Leslie Schumacher. She did she did a lot of work with OCD people, and she really helped me quite a lot to understand what the condition I had. Number one, because it was named properly for me, so it was intrusive thoughts. I have a name to it. And my brain, I can actually work with my brain to change this, you know what I mean? To stop it happening. So, and lucky enough, I've lived away from it.
Earlier on, you said to me that when you're standing in the kitchen with a knife, you wonder, have you injured anybody? Even though there's no one.
Yeah.
And you're driving and you go over a speed ramp and you wonder, was that a person? But have you ever sat in company where you said, afraid, am I?
I'd be looking at, I would have, if I was having, I would say, I would see myself kind of hitting somebody, but I know I didn't. And I said, no, you didn't, Mel. And I'm trying to keep myself normal in front of everybody. Yeah. So it's not kind of, I'm not trying to be this, it's all in my head. So it's not played out in the actions. It's in my head. You know what I mean? So, you know, no, I didn't. No, you didn't hurt that person. No, they're still sitting there, Mel. They're fine. You know, yeah, there's nothing wrong. There's nothing going on. Do you know what I mean? But it's just, that's the way it was. Yeah. And then, but true therapy and everything else and true getting all an understanding of what these were, the thoughts were. And I've got loads of admiration for your, for Jimmy, isn't it?
Jimmy.
Yeah. And because my son has the same, OCD type. But it's just, like I feel I'm lucky. My son is severe and so is Jimmy, but I'm mid OCD. Okay. So I've got there's mid and there's mild. And they're severe, and you know Jimmy and my son has severe, and I've got mid, so it's lesser of.
And you found just again in terms of treatment, which is probably the most important part of the conversation, Maddie. You found one to one cognitive behavior therapy, which is dealing with the here and now and the symptoms.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
found that worked. How do you think it worked, looking back?
Because it allowed you just to first of all just to be calm, to stop. Not to run with the thought, to bring yourself back to yourself. Do you know what I mean? So just to be, to have that calmness in yourself, because it's like somebody, say if somebody turned around and you were sitting in your chair and gave you a thump in the back of your back.
Okay.
And you've suddenly got the fright in your life, and that's what it is. The thought is like a thump in your back. Do you know what I mean? And bringing you out of yourself, you know, out of your body virtually. You know, which you did. Like, I used to feel, you know, like, my God, you know, because it just shocks you. Because they just, people with OCD don't want to hurt people. Do you know what I mean? That is the thing of it. That's the major thing, is not to harm any others, not to harm anyone else. It's the part in your brain that you want to keep things safe, is overactive. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And how many sessions of CBT before it began to make an impact on you?
Well, you see, when I was younger, I had OCD, but we didn't know it was called OCD because it wasn't diagnosed at that time.
Yeah, yeah.
So later on, when I was with Leslie, it was it was quite a long time that we had together, actually. Yeah, not like for therapy sessions and stuff. Okay. Do you know what I mean? So it was, everyone's different.
Yeah. And how are you doing now?
Oh, I'm doing really good now. Yeah, the last couple of years. Yeah, definitely. I'm much better. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but I hate when somebody says I got a touch of something. That's the only thing. I've got a touch of OCD. No, you don't. You have it or you don't. You know what I mean?
Okay.
So it's kind of, and that to me is because it minimizes the actual torture that you've heard today of what people go through.
Okay.
And you know,
say what it's meant. I want to come back to Jimmy with the same question about how he dealt with it after this break. Joe at RT.ie, 51551 is the text number, 0818 715 815.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And to come back to Jimmy and OCD and your treatment for it, Jimmy, what worked for you? CBT.
CBT did work, you know, and with the obsessive rituals, basically it was, if you took, say, the first 200 things you were afraid of, light switches, door handles, whatever, going out, take the first 100. Pick the first four then that you find the least scary, and we'd work on them, making me do these things and learn how to relax while doing them.
And but the act was important, the doing.
Oh, the doing, yeah. And at the time, AIDS was a big thing at the time. It was massive, right? It was 85, you know, early 80s, mid 80s. And contamination turned into me a fear of getting AIDS. Now, I wasn't even sexually active at the time, but in my head, I could say, right, if I had a little cut on my hand and there was a little bit of blood on that handle, It could get into me. Now, I wasn't afraid of catching AIDS. I was afraid of giving it to someone else.
Okay.
So it's always the same. Your fear of hurting someone else. Do you know what I mean? So you're never... So, as I said, then you pick the next four. Then the next four. And before you know it, you kind of...
Okay.
Get rid of nearly all your compulsions.
And what now, would you say? Because when people hear, Jimmy, when people hear OCD, and then especially if anyone develops it or thinks they're developing it, they'll go into a panic. I hear all these awful stories, people afraid to go out of the house, people afraid to handle money. What would you say to them?
I would like to know, let them know that there is help out there. But okay. Again, you have to dedicate yourself to it fully. And if it's, I've seen so many people out there that say want to give up cigarettes. No, they don't really want to give up cigarettes. So eventually they give them up for 2 weeks and then they're back on. The people that are determined to give up cigarettes will give them up and go off them. And that's what the kind of dedication you need to go into this CBT and medication. You have to go in to say, oh yeah, I'm going to get better. This is my primary objective in life at the moment, is to get better. And put everything into getting better.
So you have to focus, concentrate on that.
Concentrate. All I wanted to do was get my life back. I had a fantastic girlfriend at the time, who later on became my wife. I look back, I've 3 fabulous kids. Now they're all adults at the moment. I have a fantastic life that I never thought I would have.
Okay.
And now that I'm here, I say, geez, I may as well enjoy myself now.
Yeah. But remember, now, with smoking, the tobacco companies, as we know, deliberately, it is addictive. There is a physical addiction.
Well, you can
tobacco,
get addicted
as in
to
alcohol.
The OCD as well. You can kind of become, nearly dependent that this is your life and this is the way it's going to be. And you can get better. Like, I know no one super. So if I can get better, anyone can get better. It can be done.
Meredith, what would your advice be to somebody who's panicking now and saying, oh God, I think I'm developing OCD, or and your phrase, in intrusive thoughts. What would you say to them? Are you with me, Mela? No.
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah. What would you say to them?
I'd advise them to get some help and talk to somebody who's able to help them, because you need to have the right person, and you need to have the right person for you as well. Do you know what I mean? That fits with you and things, because it is it's. It's the anxiety is like, it's like it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger, the vibration of it, and goes into your life more and more and more and more and more. And the sooner you could actually capture it and take it back to yourself, you know, to if I'm making sense at all, I'm not sure.
You are.
So it kind of it comes back to you, and then you're able to you ownership again of yourself. You need to get ownership of yourself back. You know what I mean? And that's the key thing. And to know, to know who you are. And then when you get stronger and stuff like that, and you look after yourself and you sleep well and all those type of things, that they're really good to help you, well. Do you know what I mean? To eat well, to sleep well and all those type of things. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So, and get help.
Okay. Yeah,
help.
Well said. Al, good afternoon, Al.
Yeah, good afternoon, Joe.
You're listening to Jimmy and Mela.
Indeed, I'm intrigued by the level of conversation and the honesty of the participants. Yeah. It's quite informative.
And your contribution and your reaction, please, Al.
Well, basically, I would have a long journey with OCD, and right from 17, I'm now in my 80th year.
Okay.
And I know the journey of cognitive behavior therapy. I know the journey of support groups.
Yeah.
And I would just make a couple of small points. One I heard recently, which I thought was very valuable. Sometimes you could be looking at events in a daily life through the lens of your thought. I thought it was a gem that I heard. You could be looking through the lens of your thought. In other words, instead of seeing the reality of what is there, you're seeing it through perhaps the intrusive thought. And thoughts themselves come in. I think psychologists say there are about 4,000 thoughts coming through our brain every day. And the difficulty with OCD is that it's the response to it. In other words, it's the hanging on to it. And that's why the concept of acceptance comes in. A paper is written, it's accessible from St. Patrick's Hospital on the counter inside the door, if you like, or you can ring them and call the helpline as well for assistance. I would advise people to do that. But there's a wonderful document on acceptance, and it gives you a great resume of understanding what this concept of acceptance is. In other words, I'm having one of these thoughts now, but do I have to respond in what you were talking about, the compulsive way? And that can retrack you and put you on the other line. It's only a small contribution, but the conversation is just terribly helpful to the people of the nation, and it's wonderful to see the condition exposed in such a proficient way.
And Al, you mentioned St. Patrick's. I presume you're referring to St. Patrick's in Stephen's Lane in Dublin.
Absolutely. I would have gone to an outpatient there, and then I would have joined a support group there, and what have you. And all this leads you on the journey of exposure, which basically you're trying to do. I've been in a lot of countries in the world, and I still have the intrusive thought about harming somebody, but I was able to go there in God's grace. I'm also a Christian, and also I would believe that if people can turn to the higher power, be it God or whatever,
where
is in their own
power
faith.
Is,
Then the point is that I'd be a Catholic myself, and I have found my Christian involvement has been of great assistance to my journey. I took up a guitar at 44 years of age and played Christian music for following 15 years.
Brilliant. Just on the, I'm trying to go back to, well, it's a long time since I was studying psychology, trained to be a social worker. But yeah, I thought the number of thoughts that went through our brain, Al, was much more than 4,000
a day. Oh, it could be thousands.
It might be 4,000 an hour.
4,000 has just jumped out of my head. It could be 40,000, you know.
Incredible.
Yeah, they're like clouds. One of the pieces I heard along on the journey was by a person teaching us was that an outpatient scenario, and it was that thoughts are like clouds. You know, they're coming. If you look up to the sky. And there's one other gem. Well, I'm calling it a gem, not in an arrogant way, but I hope I've been humble about it. Oh, it's just getting out of my head for a minute. Sorry, come back to me. But
the clouds.
Yeah, it's like a cloud. In other words, it's just passing. And it's your response to it that actually makes the difference, you know. But there's one other point there. I'm sorry I missed it. It just jumped out of my head. But the program is tremendous.
Al, I'm mesmerized by one line in your message here. Another example is that I might be worried I threw someone out with the rubbish.
It's all part of the. I think you can have intrusive thought about anything. Again, it's about you can hear it in your program. The underlying themes in OCD are very similar: contamination, harming another. All these are what I call themes. And they run through the condition. The experience of each individual is subjective.
Okay, and how are you doing now, Al? Are you doing as well as sound?
It's the exposure. In other words, if you're doing something, just like the lady was saying there, and you say, "Excuse me, is this real or unreal? Am I in a reality?" And you keep doing it, then basically, you know, certainly that aspect of me with regard to bearing thing that has diminished completely.
Okay.
Yeah, that's good.
Okay. So, Al, and it's the message I'm gathering, I hope I am, and putting words into peace, but Al, there is hope, obviously.
Absolutely. No, do you know what the secret is? The secret goes back to 1970 when the American began to study this subject, and it was they that discovered that the brain was dynamic. that the brain could change. And they put colour material into the brain. They gave people placebo and other medication, and they studied the difference, and they discovered that the brain can change. And it shocked the medical world at the time. Okay. And the brain can change. And that's what that cognitive behavior therapy is telling the brain. This is unreal, and it's changing its mold. The wiring changes.
Okay, excellent. Okay, Al Gurumila, Margaret Mella and Jimmy Blake. Fascinating conversation.
Joe at RT.ie.
Coogahane, Coogahane.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And Joe at RT.ie. On the eve of International Women's Day, Jerry Sweeney has contacted us because we were talking last week about Sean O'Casey. Let's sideline Sean O'Casey for a sec, the great, great playwright, because his wife, Eileen, was a very, very formidable actress and indeed writer. She wrote three books, but she's often forgotten. And I'm just thinking on this eve of the eve of International Women's Day, Jerry, thank you for reminding us about Eileen Casey. And it reminds me that I heard this morning, I don't know what I was listening to in the early hours, but there is a woman who is writing on Wikipedia. Her task now is to write about women who've been forgotten in history, and often forgotten under the shadow, so to speak, of their not necessarily more talented husband, so to speak, though O'Casey was extraordinarily talented, but their more well-known husband. Jerry, good afternoon. You came in with an interesting little fact about Eileen O'Casey's family and a connection to the Blacksod Lighthouse in County Mayo. Jerry, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
Okay.
Yes, Eileen, she was Eileen Carey.
That's
before
right, yeah.
She married O'Casey. And her father-in-law, Brian Carey, was the contractor that built Blacksod Lighthouse. And he'd have built it back. The light was first established in June 1866.
Okay, so tell us about, what do you know about Eileen O'Casey's father? In other words, Sean O'Casey's father-in-law.
Well, he was a building contractor and a businessman in Belmullet, and okay. he worked around the area. There are still plenty of relations in the area, but I think after him building the lighthouse in Blacksod, I think he went bankrupt. And after that, I don't know anything at all, Joe.
Okay, well, then Eileen O'Casey, as I say, was born in Dublin in December 1900. By the way, she lived till the great age of 94. In other words, she died in 1995. She was a very accomplished actress, a very accomplished and very well educated raconteur as well. She was friendly with, again, all the great writers of the day. And then when she met Sean O'Casey, she was interested in, well, some people say obsessed, but in a lovely way. She was interested in his work, as a lot of people are. I would have loved to meet John O'Casey myself. And when she met John O'Casey, he absolutely fell immediately head over, totally in heels, head over heels in love with her. And she was 17 years his junior, which is not that great these days. And they were married thereafter and had a number of children. And then they had a tragedy. 21-year-old Brian got leukemia, and it wouldn't happen today, by the way. As I was at a lecture last week by Professor Owen from UCD now, and he's an incredible hematologist, but he was making the point in his inaugural lecture that the leukemia rates of survival now, they used to be when we were children, they used to be 5%. Now the survival rates are 95%. But anyway, that's just the O'Casey family and leukemia going back. And in terms of as I say, Eileen herself, and she wrote a book called Eileen about herself. She wrote a book called Sean about herself, and she wrote a third book, Sean, about her husband. And by the way, highly regarded books. But Jerry, tell us about Blacksod Lighthouse then. Let's go there for a sec.
Well, Blacksod Lighthouse, as I say, the light was first established June 1866. and it's been operating since. It's an automatic lighthouse. I myself, my two brothers and my sister, we grew up there as kids because our father looked after the light. So I was 18, 19 years of age before I left Blacksod Lighthouse to go out into the real world.
And what was it like living in a lighthouse?
Oh, it was something else, Joe. It's hard to explain to people nowadays. But the walls of the lighthouse, the walls of our bedroom, actually, at high tide, the water would be slapping up against the walls of the bedroom. And during the storms, you'd hear the rocks banging off the bedroom wall. And my dad used to tell us, when we'd be a little bit frightened over this banging against the wall, Dad used to tell us, well, that's the whales banging their tails off the wall.
And was it a lonely existence?
No. Don't forget, Blacksod Lighthouse is on the mainland. In the village. But it wasn't lonely. Afterwards, I went full-time as a lighthouse keeper on lighthouses out at sea.
Wow.
I never felt lonely on them. It was a quiet life, all right. But no, I never felt lonely on lighthouses.
And would you be in a lighthouse on your own?
Oh, no. There'd be always three lighthouse keepers all together, and your tour of duty was 28 days on and 28 days off.
But say you couldn't stand each other.
No comment.
Well, let me put it, Jerry, were you in a durable relationship with the other lighthouse keepers?
Oh, I was, my time. I was very lucky. All the lightkeepers around the coast to tell you the same thing. Now, there might be one or two kind of awkward fellas, but there was ways of getting along with them too.
And were you ever, you must have been in a lighthouse during a horrific storm. Were you ever frightened?
I was once, Joe, on Eagle Island Lighthouse. That's just off the Mullah Peninsula here in 1986.
Okay.
A hurricane came back across the Atlantic. Hurricane Charlie, it was called.
Oh, yeah.
And I was on it that night. That was very bad. That was the only time ever I got the wind up, as the fella says.
And what do you mean you thought the lighthouse would have been swept away?
Yeah. Yeah, the waves, we were roughly 200 feet above the high water mark in the accommodation block, and the seas just come in over Eagle Island. Eagle Island is where it's situated. It's near the continental shelf. So when you get big seas building up, hitting that shelf, they rise. And they come up and they hit the base of the cliffs on Eagle Island, and the water comes up over. Now, when I say water, I'm not talking white foam. I'm talking solid green seas, you know.
Wow.
And when you're inside in the building, actually, you know when the sea is over you because you can feel the compression, the air in your ears being compressed.
And would you see, because I remember when I was on Inishman, and I go there quite a lot, I remember when I was out walking one afternoon, I came across a group of American students. And they were and obviously lecturers, and they were interested in not just archaeology, but the history of rock and stone formations, etc. And they were looking at this massive rock, which was the size of two car parking spaces, so to speak, if you look at it that way. And I said, how many thousand years has that been there? A million years? And the lecturer said to me, that would have been thrown up onto this spot during a storm in the last 2 years. The power the power of a storm could lift rocks of hundreds of tons.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, the sea is just it's all powerful, all powerful.
It's
lovely. It's lovely. I used to love watching the sea on a calm day. It's nice. Yeah, you're looking, you know, on a slack calm. But also during the storms, there's beauty in it. Looking at it, you know.
Yeah.
The ways it behaves.
And when you're doing, I'm told you do tours of the lighthouse.
We do tours in Blacksod Lighthouse.
Okay.
Yeah,
and so you mentioned D-Day.
D-Day,
explain the D-Day connection again. And Maureen,
well, my parents, my grandmother and my parents and an aunt of mine, they used to do the weather forecasting for Met Aaron here.
Yeah.
And on the Allies were to go in on the beaches of Normandy on the 5th of June, 1944.
Yeah.
But the weather that was sent from Blacksod, when Eisenhower and his staff looked at the weather report in England, they saw that there was a storm coming, the barometer was falling and all that. So they cancelled it for 24 hours. So
but, the barometer was falling on Blackside.
Yeah.
And your is it your great aunt? And I know your family were, but Maureen Flavin Sweeney, she spotted, well, that was her job.
Yeah.
They were watching it hour by hour. She spotted that the barometer was falling, so there was a storm egg chocked. I thought she'd egg chocked, and she tip tapped whatever to the American, or the Eisenhower's HQ, obviously, and this process they went through. And on the base of that information, Eisenhower put off the greatest. And the biggest land invasion in world history, he put it off for 24 hours.
That's correct. That's
incredible.
Correct. Now, at the time, my parents, they didn't know the route of the weather, where it was going.
Yeah,
And it was a long time after World War II ended that they found out about it, you know.
Wow.
But, because Ireland was supposed to be neutral, but there was an agreement pre-World War II that countries in Europe shared their weather reports.
And when you're mentioning, to come back to Sean O'Casey and the history D-Day, and you mentioned the Sean O'Casey connection in the building of it, do people inquire about Eileen, given that I'm trying to focus on women that are almost forgotten under the shadow of their famous husbands for the week that's in it. Do you mention Eileen, or do people know about Eileen?
Well, some people do, but most of them wouldn't know Joe. But tell them the local connection, you know.
Because she was the love of his life, and she, as people know as well, as well as being an accomplished actress in her own right, with many other attributes, including writing, as we know, Sean O'Casey was not a well man. His eyesight troubled him from an early age, and people believe that O'Casey lived a long life thanks to the care and support of Eileen. And then people are texting me in saying people have also forgotten, now it's not directly your part of the world, you go further down into Connemara, the artist Paul Henry, his wife Grace Henry was also a fantastic artist, and some people believe even as accomplished. Cherry, you're training to be a lighthouse keeper. What do you obviously reading the weather, and what does the training consist of?
Weather report for the lighthouse log every hour. But when we were training, when we joined, we went to the Bailey Lighthouse out in and you were there and you were trained in communications, radio communications, fog signals, radio beacons, lights, how to maintain them, generators, everything like that. So you moved around the coast then while you were training, and you know, you'd replace lads that were sick or lads on a wedding or something like that. And after 2 years, I got appointed then permanent to a station, Tory Island, actually, up in Donegal. That's where I went to.
And you say, would you learn Morse code, for example, back in the day?
Yeah, we had to learn Morse code, and you had to do an exam at the end of your first year and go into Pembroke Street in front of the inspector and do the Morse code.
And is Morse code like riding a bike, Jerry? Once you get once you learn it, it stays with you?
That's correct. Well, it doesn't stay with you unless you keep practicing it.
Yeah,
unfortunately,
but you get it back quick. You get it back quick enough. You get it back quick enough.
Ah, you would, yeah. But they don't use it nowadays.
Yeah, of course.
You know,
The
only time you'd see Morse code now, maybe not on the key, there is a chance you'd see Morse code being used with a flashlight if somebody was in trouble, let's say. You know.
Oh, okay. And what's SOS again? Short, is it SOS is what?
Well, let's say save our souls.
Yeah, I know what it means, but sorry.
Three shorts, three longs, and three shorts.
Ah, very good. How did you power the lighthouse?
The lighthouses were powered, some of them were powered by the main navigation light by paraffin oil. Pressurized paraffin oil that you'd use a pump to pressurize it, and then some of them were electrically powered.
Wow. And of course, then there was the horrific accident in it's Black Rock Island, of course.
Black Rock, that's just off us here, on the 14th of March 2017. Actually, Joe, the anniversary mass for the crew of Rescue 116 is on this coming Saturday evening at Turan Church at 6:30 p.m.
Yeah. And I'm just, I know life is life, but I can remember, and I presume it's the same for you, Jerry, but I was obviously distant. I can remember exactly where I was and who told me on that morning that R116 had gone down.
Yeah.
It was such a traumatic, such a traumatic.
And still is, you know, still is around here, Joe.
Yeah, and the fall.
You know, we hear of it happening in other areas of the world, but when it happens on your doorstep, it's a different different ball game.
And as you say, the anniversary is on the 14th.
And the Mass is next Saturday evening.
Yeah,
yes.
Tomorrow week. Yes. So we remember, of course, Dara Fitzpatrick, Mark Duffy, Paul Ormsby, who was from Ballyfermot near where I lived, and in fact, I was up in Ballyfermot this morning at a funeral of a great, great, great worker, a great public servant here in RTE, behind the scenes, a great man called Frank Martin, who died unexpectedly last week. He'd retired, but he was such a part of this organisation, and he met a lot of the public in his job, and he was, if public service had a face and a personality, it was the great Frank Martin. So regards and condolences to Teresa and the family. Paul Ormsby and, of course, Ciarán Smith. So their anniversary is, as you say, tomorrow week. We remember them. Jerry, is there any lighthouses that are still staffed?
No. They're all automatic, Joe, now. Okay. All automatic.
Okay. And what happened to all the lighthouse keepers?
Well, they were paid off and went different ways.
And what do you do after you were like? Well, obviously, there's brilliant.
After I left the lighthouses, I still work part time here at Blackstad because it's a search and rescue base. But I went into Inland Fisheries Ireland. I was a fishery officer for up to 24, 25 years.
Oh, what I meant, sorry, the other question was flashing through my head earlier. You said you'd be 28 days out there. Now, I know Blackstad is at the end of a pier, so we're fine generally. But if you were out, say, in Tory or whatever, say you had to get home for an emergency or a family crisis.
Well, they would. You would be taken ashore. You would be taken ashore. But I remember I was on Tory Island when my first child was born, my daughter Ursula, and she was 3 weeks old before I saw her.
Okay. All right. What happens to our rent? I know Hookhead is a tourist attraction. I know there's a few of them in North Donegal that I'm dying to see. But what happens? Lighthouses, they still work, but they're not staffed. So can you rent them out? Can you holiday in them?
You can rent some of them out. And it's usually local co-ops and things like that that run the visiting side. With the commissioners of Irish Lights and the county councils too are involved on them. Fannet Head, you can rent it out. Where else? Loophead, County Clare. I'm not sure. Can you rent that one out? Mm-hmm. But you can definitely go and visit it. And there's some more. There's a big one. It's not an operational lighthouse at the moment. Clare Island in County Mayo.
Okay.
So that's sold a long time ago by the Irish Lights, but you can stay there. It's all private now. I think it's some Germans or Dutch that own it.
Yeah, I'm reading a book at the minute by a woman called Bella Bathurst, which is about Scottish lighthouses. And every single lighthouse in Scotland, I don't know whether you knew this or not, Jerry, but you know me, I'm full of useless information. Every single lighthouse in Scotland was constructed by the family of Robert Louis Stevenson.
That's correct.
Yes, well, he knew it. Good man. There's a fantastic book by Bella Bathurst. She's also written a book, by the way, about going deaf, which is very disturbing. But it's called The Lighthouse Stevensons, and it is the extraordinary story, the building of the Scottish lighthouses by the ancestors of Robert Louis Stevenson.
That's incredible. Correct, Joe.
And you get an incredible sense of the life on a lighthouse and the power of the sea. The power of the sea. Mm-hmm. Okay, Jerry, go to Míle Maith. You're going to hope to see you soon.
Okay, Joe, you're welcome anytime to Blackstad.
And how do people get to visit Blacksod Lighthouse? Do they need to, well, there's a website, obviously, I presume. Are you open every day, or?
They're open to me, but they have a website, and www.visitblacksodlighthouse.ie.
Okay.
And if you go through that, they'll arrange everything for you.
Okay, I'm sure if there's a light on.
Yeah, there's a light.
God bless you, Jerry. Good
to
meet
you,
Margaret.
You won't get lost anyway. Yeah, Joe, you won't. Blacksod isn't that big.
Good to meet you, Margaret Agarod, and to you and your family and everyone down at Blacksod. And remember, we remember. Oh, Jerry, we have a question for you. Are you ready?
Yeah.
What's the question? The question comes from Dermot Phelan. Dermot. Go ahead. Your question to Jerry Sweeney on Blacksod Lighthouse.
It's lovely to hear him talking about that whole D-Day episode.
Yeah, yeah.
But I thought there was an extra twist on that story,
right,
and I was hoping
right.
he might be able to fill me in. Because, as I understood it, the Germans, they also knew the storm was coming. And the German generals are said to have gone home for the weekend because nothing was going to happen. But the lady, his great aunt, picked
Flavin
up the next
Sweeney.
Day that it was actually improving and transmitted that and allowed them to go. Is that true?
Well, it's true that Rommel left France and went home. I think he was thinking that the weather was going to break and they wouldn't do it, you know. They wouldn't invade, but as it turned out, you know, they got the information that the weather was on the pickup again, and they went ahead then on the 6th of June.
Yeah, yeah. So it was
a double
double benefit, really.
Yeah, it was. So what you're saying, Dermot, on the one hand, Maureen said and told the powers that be, and we presume the Germans intercepted it, and they're still, well, the Russians are doing the interceptions these days of the Germans. But we presume the Germans intercepted it, and the message from Maureen was, and from the Sweeney family in Blacksod there where Jerry is, there's a storm coming. All the Germans went home from Normandy, and the German generals, obviously, the fortifications stayed. And by the time they got back to Germany, within the next 24 hours or 18 hours, Maureen had Morse code again, say the storm is lifting, so Eisenhower went.
Yes.
And
yes.
That's an incredible twist.
Yeah.
Okay, Dermot, I thought the Irish leading expert on D-Day is David Duffy, who is the runs Duffy Circus's family owner. But he is the greatest expert I've ever come across on D-Day. Extraordinarily knowledgeable. Are you an expert on it, Dermot?
Oh, not really, no. I'm from down around there, West Mayo, and we have family connections with the
Lighthouse. Have you been on Blacksod Lighthouse?
Oh, I have, for sure.
Oh, good.
Yeah,
Hopefully you'll get many visitors. Jerry, is I presume I have to pay a few bob for a tour.
I think it's €5.
Oh, for God's sake.
And there's concessions then for the elderly.
That's nothing. Yeah. Sure, that wouldn't keep the light on for 10 minutes.
Yeah, and you can listen to me too for
half
an hour.
Love that. I'd love that. You can multiply that fee by 10 and there'll still be great value. Go to meet him, I got Jerry Sweeney, Dermot Phelan. Just on joe@rte.ie, 51 joe@rte.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And Joe at RT Daddy. Jacqueline, when did this happen?
Last night into the early hours of this morning, so probably about 3 o'clock.
Okay, 3 o'clock this morning. What happened and where?
We had gone to a concert, we'd gone to see Rick Astley.
Okay.
And he was brilliant. He was down the point, and we ended up in a little sidebar off there, and we were coming up a well-known street.
Grafton Street. Don't be afraid to say it. Grafton Street.
Well, it was Grafton Street, yeah. We were staying around the corner. And there was these four, I'd say they were between, say, 16 and 18. If they were 18, they were small. And they were kicking around this kind of carton.
Okay.
And there was a poor homeless person sleeping in the doorway. And I just said, look, do you mind not kicking that poor person's trying to sleep?
Okay.
And there was a lot of expletives roared and a lot of four-letter words. And basically, you know, if my husband hadn't stood in front of them with me, I think something could have kicked off. And it was very intimidating.
And just to be clear, Jacqueline, you could see that this person was asleep in a doorway or whatever.
In a sleeping bag in the doorway.
Yeah.
And didn't care. And one of these...
They could see them.
Oh, they could see them quite clearly. Their legs were sticking out of the doorway in the sleeping bag. And like kept saying, I don't give an F about this person. Because I said, oh my God. That's disgraceful, I said. Like, how can you behave like that? I don't give an F. And like really, really screaming all over Grafton Street. And like when we were walking in yesterday, there was one guard, which I said to my husband, oh my God, because you never see guards there. Never. We come into town every few months for a concert or to meet people or whatever, and you never see a guard. And I just exclaimed to my husband, and I said, oh my God, like an actual guard. And then up the top of Grafton Street, four guards.
And were you minded to say it to them?
I just looked at them. They were having a little bit of a mother's meeting at the top of Grafton Street. They didn't notice me. There should have been two in the middle, or two at the end and two at the top and one in the middle. But there wasn't. There was nobody in the middle. Do you know what I mean? And then around that time...
But what could they have said? But then again, what could they have said to the ump to stop kicking the bottle?
Well, they could have stopped the guy. Like, I'm not an 18-year-old girl. I'm a 58-year-old grandparent. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm hardly going to take them on. They were just intimidating. It wasn't even a bottle. It was like a takeaway kind of plastic food tin that made a lot of noise.
That rattled.
And this poor pair, when I looked in there, I just thought, oh my God, what is wrong with people? If people know empathy anymore, are people brought up with no empathy? You know, not to even care about this poor person, like in the doorway trying to sleep. And this person's gone out of their way deliberately to do this.
What age again do you think they were, Jacqueline?
I'd say if they were probably about 16, where they were going that hour of the night, I don't know.
Yeah, it's a school night as well, as the fella said.
Exactly.
3 o'clock this morning, rambling down Grafton Street. Where would you get it?
Exactly, four of them. And like basically it was the middle guy that was like, he was just angling for an argument with somebody. And like I'm Fred in my own shadow. I wouldn't argue with anybody. I just thought it was just so horrible that this poor person was trying to sleep at that hour of the morning and somebody like that doing that.
And how did it finish up, as they say?
Do you know something? I cried all the way home from the hotel.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Just with upset.
And I emailed
your
show at that time of the night, that time of the morning, because I was so shocked at what happened. That's the way society is going. I have a 6-year-old and a 19-month-old grandchild. If a little girl, a little boy, if they behaved like that, I'd be quick enough to say to them, that's not nice.
There, but for the grace of God.
100%. I mean, God.
And was there, were they out of their heads, to use a phrase, Jacqueline?
Pardon?
Had they alcohol on them?
They didn't look out of their head. They might have been high on something. I don't know. They didn't look out of their head. They just looked like, well, especially him, the ringleader. He looked like he was just angling for an argument with anybody.
Yeah.
You know, to pick on a poor defenceless person sleeping in a doorway, minding their own business.
And it was a cold night out there. It was a cold night.
It was freezing last night. Yeah.
And again, I'm thinking of Mount Street as well, and the conversation we had on Friday when people were deeply upset. But anyway, I know there was movement on Friday afternoon and Friday night, but it seems to have gone back. Let's hope things will change. Things will change quickly.
Well, I just wish, you know, people would be more mindful.
And when you said that, just that picture.
You started screaming at me.
But just that picture you're giving me of you went home and you cried all the way home. Has that happened? Have you witnessed scenes like that before, that would upset
you? My husband was on to you one day, and we were on the Lewis, maybe about a year and a half ago, and a guy started lighting up crack on front of us, beside us on the Lewis. Now, that's two times. Yeah. I love this city. I'm from here.
Yeah.
I'm a Crumlin girl. My husband's a cameraman, and like I love here. I mean, the day that I stopped coming into this city,
of course,
I love it.
Yeah, here.
You know, I bring my granddaughter in here. I bring her up Grafton Street to the Lego shop, the Disney shop. You know, I'm not going to stop coming in here. But I mean, like, you know, five police people, you know, men and women on the street are not going to solve this. And plus, you can't just blame the police. You have to blame, like, I mean, somebody is not teaching these guys. You know, I know you're born with MC, you have it. But you have to be also showed.
Yeah.
You know, and to behave like that, society has, for me personally, has broken down if somebody can behave like that.
Yeah. I agree with you. And I know, anyone who's been to New York, now it's a long time since I've been to New York, but I was struck where there was major junctions. And I'm thinking of the top of Grafton Street, by the way. You were saying the three guards or whatever were standing at the top of Grafton Street. Maybe they didn't see it. But, okay, but if there was an elevated observation post, so to speak, where Gardaí could be in out of cold as well.
Exactly.
They could see all the full length of Grafton. And they could have one at
100%.
the Spire as well. But anyway, these are different operational matters. Jacqueline and Rick Ashley was good. You're never going to give him up, are you?
I'm never going to give him up now.
He's getting better with age, isn't he?
He's certainly, he's like a good bottle of wine, Joe.
And someone who was saying to me that they used to go and see Rick Astley in the Olympia.
I went to see him in the Olympia. He was better in the Olympia, but see, he did Glastonbury, and it reignited his career, and that's how he can play in the three now, you know. But I do prefer him in the Olympia.
Yeah, but he's only 58. He's only a child.
58. He's the same age as myself.
He's only a child.
He's only a boy.
Yeah, great. And come here. Was the pint more expensive than the Olympia?
Kind of, you know. I suppose.
It's a great venue. Like, I know that.
Oh, it's a great
lesson, isn't it, Rick Ashley? Growing up, when he was very, very big. Then he kind of, like everyone does, there was a valley, so to speak. I'm sure he sold 40 million records. It wasn't that much of a valley. And then the sunny uplands came back and he's headlining in the Point.
Absolutely. And he was like leaving from last night. He had been in Belfast the night before and he was heading to Liverpool tonight.
And did he get a good reaction last night?
Oh my God, he was absolutely amazing. But the show that he puts on is unbelievable.
Wow. Jam-packed.
A lot of women.
Ah, yeah, that's hilarious.
Yeah, a lot of women. But there was a good few couples there and it was brilliant, the atmosphere.
Well, your chap was there, wasn't he?
Well, my husband booked the tickets. He
great. Okay, Jacqueline. Rick Ashley, never going to give it. And keep that empathy, Jacqueline. It's a great, and that passion, yeah. Okay.
Yeah,
okay. Take
thanks
it easy.
So much,
thanks.
Joe.
Thanks indeed. That's Jacqueline O'Reilly. Joe at rt.ie 51551 text.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Oh, there seems to be a taste of sour cream and onion over something I said earlier about Tato Chris. Martin Taylor, good afternoon.
Afternoon, Joe. Oh, before we start on that topic, the real man is coming to Dublin on Sunday. Marty Pella was in.
I see him.
That's where you get your real Joe.
You have a minute. Come on, check me on.
Mr. Perry was the first packet of crisps to have the little packet of salt.
I don't believe it.
And we used to get them at Mr. Carter's in Bolton Street.
And can you verify the year, caller?
1963.
And how can you prove it's 1963?
Well, I have a birth certificate and I was 9 years old at the time.
Okay, now, I put it to you, through the chair, I put it to you, Mr. Taylor, that...
Martin.
Okay, thank you for that. Excuse my informality there. Martin, I put it to you that Tato Crisps were established by Mr. Spud Murphy 70 years ago. Today, which would bring us back to 1954, Your Honour.
Yeah, but he wasn't selling them then, Joe. Mr. Cardle was selling Mr. Perry crisps in 1963.
Okay, I stand
along with his along with his Lucky Lumps, his Trigger Bars, his Licorice, his Bullseyes, his Lucky Bags, and his Cough Sweets, his Gobstoppers.
And would you explain, Martin, for our younger listeners, what was a Lucky Lump?
A Lucky Lump was, you were buying it with the with the prospect of getting a sixpenny piece in it.
Ah.
And you'd be sucking them for about 4 hours.
You couldn't do that now.
Well, I tell
you'd
you, Joe.
You'd be sued.
Well, no, in fairness now, I had many's lucky lump, and I didn't have to go to Turkey to get me teeth done. I still have all my own teeth.
Good lad. And you have them. I see them. You have them in the glass there beside the bed, said you.
Every morning, smiling at me.
Well done, Martin. Well, by the way, Martin, the St. Patrick's Day Festival have been back on to us about, we want to know how much Tato paid them for to become the mascot for the Paddy's Day Parade. They said it was a snack decision. Back tomorrow, 1:45. Annette, you can produce. Ray Darcy is next.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Elevate your bedroom with our fresh new bedding designs and colours, in-store and online at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815 stays open until 3:15 p.m. or email joe@rte.ie.